So She Talks is a collaboration with the Southwest Ohio Council for Higher Education. It's an effort to bring Miami Valley research and thinking into the public arena, a way to enlighten the world with local knowledge. This week, our speaker is Dr. Joseph Watrous with the School of Education and Allied Professions at the University of Dayton. Today's topic, the fascinating history of racial desegregation of Dayton schools.
The plan was very simple. The racially homogeneous schools were on opposite sides of the river. And so the court master simply paired elementary and secondary schools, which were about 4 or 5 miles apart, and sent some pupils from one school to another and vice versa. What was interesting, though, is that although it was very successful and had a high level of public support when it began, by 1986, public support changed so that in 2002, city and school officials complained that the program of busing caused white flight and did not increase the academic achievement of black students. Let's go back to 1954. And after the Supreme Court decision about separate schools, racially separate schools, that is, the superintendent in Dayton received a letter asking if there could be some change about the segregated nature of Dayton schools. He replied that they were not segregated. That was true in one sense, that is, there was no policy requiring black students to attend all black schools. However, in Dayton, school attendance boundaries followed neighborhoods, and the neighborhoods tended to be racially segregated. Now, that racial segregation in the neighborhoods stemmed from many reasons. One was that the Federal Housing Authority, which underwrote mortgages for homes, required that there be covenants in most homes, except those on the west side, which forbade the sale to minority group members. Therefore, neighborhood schools were tended to be one-race schools. For example, in 1962, when Dunbar High School opened, it had a student body of 99.6 African American. In September 1966, though, there was a new attitude in Dayton about segregation. This happened as a result of a shooting. White men riding in a car through the west side of Dayton shot an African American man as he stood in front of his apartment. There was a riot that broke out in protest. Dayton's mayor created a committee to find ways to reduce those problems. Now, those difficulties, at least the segregation of the schools, should not have happened or could not, or at least people worked to try to overcome those. In 1965, the U.S. Congress passed and Lyndon Johnson signed the U.S. Civil Rights Act, which warned that no person could suffer discrimination in a federally supported program. That led to the forcing of racial desegregation in most of the southern schools in a very short period of time. But that left the northern schools without any kind of effort to bring about desegregation. The Legal Defense Fund of the NAACP had begun a program of court decisions, a program of suits. In 1968, they won Green versus Schools of New Kent County, which decided that boards had to offer more than freedom of enrollment. That's the way Dayton had argued that they don't have segregated schools. It was available to anybody to move wherever they wanted. But what the court said was they have to show that people have actually used it. In Dayton, they had not. In 1972, in Keyes versus School District in Colorado, what the Supreme Court found was that a school board was guilty of mandating segregation if attendance zones created one-race schools. That was the case in Dayton, where attendance zones, in as much as they followed neighborhoods and the neighborhoods were segregated, then they were guilty of setting up segregated schools. Now, Wayne Carl was the superintendent, came to Dayton in 1969, and he worked towards getting desegregation in the schools. He had two supporters. One was the Dayton View Stabilization Program, which was headed by a gentleman named Joe Wine. And that program used a federally funded program, Multiple Motivation, to introduce quality education to neighborhoods which were undergoing transition. The second supporter, or the second group of supporters, came from administrators and teachers in Dayton Catholic schools. They had tried to desegregate their own schools, but had been unsuccessful, and they worked to try to support the desegregation of public schools. They were at the same time two major opponents of desegregation. One was on the West Side, and this was a federally funded program of model cities. It was called the Model Cities Demonstration Program, and Black Power activists took control of this program, and they tried to prevent racial integration on the grounds that Black people should control their own schools, and they had several programs in place that desegregation would weaken. The second were two people who resigned from Dayton schools. One had been an assistant principal. They created a political party serving our schools. They won seats on the school board. They won a majority in 1972, and they strove to retain neighborhood schools. Well, in 1972, the NAACP filed suit in U.S. District Court. They asked for metropolitan desegregation. Now, that would have prevented anybody from fleeing the Dayton schools to avoid desegregation, because it would have asked that all the surrounding schools, the suburban areas, Oakwood and Kettering and those schools, all participate in a desegregation program. But in 1974, the Supreme Court, in the case with Detroit, Milliken versus Bradley, argued that a court could not require desegregation involving suburban areas unless lawyers could show that the segregation that occurred as a result of those other districts was caused by officials, that if there was something that they had done purposefully to bring about segregation, there was no such proof possible. So that restricted the desegregation program to the city of Dayton alone. At any rate, in 1976, the buses rolled, school doors opened, and we had a very successful program. No violence, high rates of attendance, and no evidence of white flight. In 1986, though, things changed, and then the Supreme Court made a decision, Riddick versus School Board, which allowed school districts to dismantle court-ordered desegregation. And in April 2002, representatives from Dayton Schools, from the NAACP, and the Ohio Department of Education agreed to end efforts to bring about racial balance in the schools. Now, even though they had ended it, and they said that it was going to be an improvement or bring about an improvement in Dayton schools, it did not. Segregation increased and school problems remained. So from 2000 to 2004, at least six elementary schools increased enrollments of white students and seven elementary schools increased enrollments of Black students. Although there was some hope that the end of desegregation would bring about an improvement in academic achievement, it did not. In fact, in 2004, Dayton schools remained on the bottom of the state achievement scores for a third consecutive year. In 2006, the voters rejected a tax support, and a team of consultants from the Council of the Great City Schools who came to Dayton to see what the school board could do to improve the schools said, this place is drifting and there's no plan for improvement. Well, one of the arguments for ending desegregation was that it had caused white flight. And that's a very interesting question, whether or not desegregation caused white flight. It should have been the case that if we end desegregation, then the white flight should have ended. It has not. It's continued on and probably will still continue. In 2003, the Miami Valley Regional Planning Commission hired consultants to do a survey of the Dayton City difficulties, or at least of this area. And what they found was that in Dayton, that most of the students in most of the schools, at least half, were on free lunch, which meant that they came from low-income families, or federally supported lunch programs, I should say. And that meant that they were from low-income families. In the suburban communities, that was not the case. And in Dayton, most of the students, at least a half of them, were from non-Asian minority families. That was not the case in the suburban areas either. Now, did desegregation itself cause the white flight? Now, that's an interesting question itself, or still the same question. And from some statistics that came from the Ohio Board of Education showed that from 1968 to 1975, remember, 76 is the desegregation program. So in those years just before the desegregation, the percentage of white students in Montgomery County enrolled in suburban schools increased 1% per year. So there's a limit going out of Dayton and going into the suburbs at about 1%. That rate of increase jumped to 3% from 75 to 77, and then afterwards it returned back to that 1% rate. Well, if that's true, that is that if the desegregation program brought about an increase of about 3% in the exodus of white students from Dayton to the suburban areas. That is also true about other cities in the United States. Charles Klotfelter, using national data, found the same tendencies in other cities. He argued that it was somewhere between 4% and 6%, that it would increase, and then it would go back to what it had been before. At any rate, the ending of busing did not affect the trend of middle-class people leaving Dayton. What is the culprit? Well, according to that study that I quoted earlier, the one that came from the Miami Valley Planning Commission, the culprit was the state of Ohio's financial system, because that pitted communities against each other, bidding to attract businesses, offering, and they would do that by offering tax reductions. Middle-class residents followed the businesses. And at the same time, the region experienced a significant loss of population as industries moved out of Dayton. Did racial desegregation help African-American students? Remember, that was one of the other complaints, was that desegregation did not help African-American students. Well, in 2006, two researchers did a fairly extensive study using extremely sophisticated measures, and what they found was that there were consistent and persistent gaps in academic achievement and also in teenage pregnancy between white students and black students. Desegregation did not solve those problems. However, it did improve the situation of African-American students, at least relative to the position of white students in a similar situation. So racial desegregation didn't bring about dramatic improvement, but it certainly improved it, at least reduced the number of factors which African-American students had to face in order to achieve better in school, to improve school performance. I don't know of any similar study that took place in Dayton, but one would assume that the tendencies would be about the same here. And it is in some ways surprising that attitudes about desegregation changed so dramatically in the absence of evidence that it was causing harm. Nonetheless, people would repeat that it did cause harm and thereby end the program. I want to thank you for your attention, and I want to thank the sponsors of this program for inviting me to participate here. I've had a good time, and I hope you have too. Thank you.
Dr. Joseph Watrous with the University of Dayton. You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning.